I'm Joe Bondosky.
And I'm Jay Washburn.
And this is Start Writing. We are on to the sense of smell. this episode. So this will be a discussion piece, and we're going to talk about incorporating that as well. But this week we have a few items on This Week in Critiques, and two items on Writing True this week. So it's rare and wonderful that way, I guess. So one thing I forgot to mention when we were discussing sound, and if you got the newsletter, I put this in here. And so there was a company that created what they called Dreamscapes. And what a dreamscape was is they would take sounds from a specific setting, like the ocean or maybe like the frontier, and they would put this little loop of music together, and what it would do was create specific dreams based on those sounds. And like I said, they called them dreamscapes because of how effective they were at evoking these visual images in your dreams. So if you're kind of curious, maybe some good ideas there. You can check them out for some sounds to evoke specific settings.
That's cool.
Okay, so This Week in Critiques. I have a friend who's writing this urban fantasy, and she brought the first couple chapters of her first draft. And the very first page, like the very opening, is a journal entry of a character. And it's basically who I am, and he talks about how his dad left and how things are going, and he's going off to college. And it's like slant exposition, really, right? Because it's a journal, so it fits there without feeling like direct exposition. But at the same time, it really is just direct exposition, right? So having read that, one, I didn't feel like we started in a scene, and two, I definitely didn't feel in medias res, right? We didn't start in the middle of things. And so I said, let's cut the journal, and this, I think, is where we start. Because it's leading to this job at a newspaper that's connected to the magical world. And so this was my proposal, is job interviews don't happen in the middle of the night in dead-end alleys after being stalked by the interviewer for several blocks. But that's exactly what happened. So it's like, that's your first line. Because it's an interesting situation, and we are in the middle of it, right? I don't start off with some stranger maybe following him. I'm like, no, we're at the end of a dead-end alley. This guy's been stalking you. And yet you also know this is a job interview, which is really weird. Something to kind of spark your curiosity. So,
all right. Yeah, that's great. The Gargoyle Gazette.
So, yeah. the next one comes from Jim Butcher's Academ's Fury. I have a few quotes. I've been reading his series on this. And so this is from page 130. It says, Sarai smiled wanly at him. So I had to look this word up. And what it meant was this kind of exhausted expression.
Okay.
And so when I read it and then I looked it up, one, I felt like the verb itself didn't communicate effectively the emotional state that it was. And two, because it was an obscure word that I had to look up, I was no longer thinking about the emotional context within the story. I was thinking of the new word I learned and trying not to forget it. And so that made me think about any time you pick an obscure word, that's something you risk, right? Because Butcher, he could have said, she gave an exhausted smile, and I would have gotten that, and I had the emotional context, and I would have continued to stay in the story. But because I didn't know the word, I looked it up, and I thought about it, and it took me out of the story that way. And so that's a gamble you make anytime you choose an obscure word.
So I write mostly for a young adult audience, and I think the vocabulary building is actually almost a
part of the genre
of it.
Yeah.
But usually when I use a word that I think that I'm pretty sure that my readers won't even understand, I'll often like double describe the thing so that they kind of learn the other word through context. That causes its own problem too, but
yeah, I think,
anyway,
you know,
it's an interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely an interesting thing to look at, but for me, you know, just from the reader trying to experience the story, it was ineffective. Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of easier ways to describe this emotion. He picked this word. It didn't work for me, and it took me out.
Okay, so now what if a reader said that to you about a word that you had chosen? And you're like, come on, everybody knows that word, don't they? Like, how do you find that balance between expecting your readers to have a certain, well, I'm not, I didn't know the word either, actually. I couldn't describe what that meant.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to approach this, right? One, you know, you can just say, well, I want to expand my reader's vocabulary. Mm. Or two, you can do the gamble of redundancy, right? He says, you know, she smiled wanly, you know, and staggered with exhaustion. And so even though the exhaustion is actually describing the way she's walking, it gives you a hint of the meaning behind the wanly as well. Mm. Right? And so there's a touch of redundancy there, but it also helps in understanding that obscure word.
So I think this is how I would answer the question. If you had looked up that word and you said, oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't know this word, but it exactly describes the thing.
Yeah, I agree.
And you were kind of mediocre. You're like, yeah, that kind of.
No, like when I read it, I was like, I think that word is just weak and it doesn't describe an exhausted state very well. You know, it's like, he looks, you know, I mean, he looks a little wan. Be like, what's that mean? You know, like, but imagine like if we look at the vernacular wiped out, be like, he looks wiped out. Nobody has to explain to you what that means. You know what it means immediately.
And it's like pretty thorough too.
Yeah.
Like it captures
you know,
it well.
And so there's, you know, I think there's a difference, right? There are some words that just effectively communicate the emotional state behind them, and I don't think this was one of them. Mm. You know, I think you should have picked a different word or approached it differently. Yeah.
Okay, before we move on from critiques, if you're ready to, I had a question, which is kind of a follow-up from a question I brought up in the last episode we did together, but I have a student that asked me to look at his outline.
Right.
And sometimes I word idea of someone that I'm critiquing, and then later they're going to be upset at me saying, hey, that was my idea and you just published it. Anyway, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, you read a ton of different people's work. If they're published, I'd never worry about this issue. Uh-huh. But if they're not published, I feel like they're probably extra sensitive about someone quote unquote stealing their work.
I think they are extra sensitive about it. But I've heard several writers talk about this, be like, how many stories are about Atlantis? How many stories are about ancient Greece? How many stories are about dragons? Right? I mean, you know, think of the guy who came up with dragons, be like, that's my idea. You guys can't all write about dragons. Like, the bottom line is that ideas are cheap and a dime a dozen. Mm. You know, it's how you explore the idea and how you write the story that matter. And so my thought is, you know, writers need to worry less about their ideas being stolen. Now, if someone steals your story, that's different, right? Right. Even if the prose change, but it's like the same characters, the same plot, that's a straight up theft, right? But the premise idea, I think not that big a deal, you know. And you know, I mean, there's a great history of writers not necessarily stealing, but taking and building on the work of others. Oh. Here's a great example. I don't know if you've ever seen the Shawshank Redemption movie. I think it's just a classic masterpiece.
Yeah.
Now, it's based on the book by Stephen King, which is called Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. Now, they of course, bought those rights to do that. But Stephen King watched a movie called Escape from Alcatraz, from which he based that book, right? Huh. And Escape from Alcatraz was based on the book Escape from Alcatraz, which was in turn based on an actual escape by several men from Alcatraz. Now, if I haven't read the book, but I saw the movie Escape from Alcatraz, I thought it was really boring and really dull. I didn't read Stephen King's book either. But by the time The Shawshank Redemption is made, it is a masterpiece. And I think a lot of work goes through those phases, right? That the initial idea isn't done incredibly well the first time through. Like, I even heard someone saying that Dan Brown had written several works of fiction that were just kind of throwaway, and people had seen a couple of them. They said he was basically writing The Da Vinci Code over and over and over as different novels, and none of them were good enough to publish. Hmm. And then The Da Vinci Code finally came out, and it was fully developed at that point. So whether you're an individual, you know, you may write the same idea several times until you get it right. Or in the case of The Shawshank Redemption, it went through, you know, several different artists before it really reached fruition.
Well, and if you were to contrast those two stories, there are certainly similarities, but the difference is probably greater than the similarities almost.
If you can take an afternoon and watch Escape from Alcatraz and The Shawshank Redemption, and the differences are huge. Mm-hmm. You know, the similarities are kind of how they escape and, you know, a few other really basic things, but the characters are so different. And in The Shawshank Redemption, they are so well developed and complex, and that is where the real magic of the story comes into place. You know, this, you know, like we look at Red and you know, he talks about Andy, about like there's no place for hope in here. And then you have that final scene of Red saying, "I hope to see my friend again." You know, like Andy had brought hope back to Red, who had given up on life in prison.
That's so cool.
You know,
it's powerful, huh?
Yeah, powerful, powerful story. But it took many artists to finally bring that story to fruition.
Yeah. A lot of building.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been that writer who's like, don't take my idea. Don't take my idea. It's so good. Like, it's not good until it's done well.
So, I tend to be pretty open with my ideas. Like I've told a lot of people about the project I'm working on.
Mm.
But I just noticed that a lot of beginning students are
really
worried about that. And so that makes me worry that they're going to be upset about, hey, that was my idea. Like, nah, come on. That was, anyway, I'm not trying to steal it, but I am just worried about.
I don't think you will all, anything that you read and enjoy or watch and enjoy, you will be influenced by at some point.
Man, I look at the novels that I've written, and I can just list all the novels that I read while I was writing it, and you can see the influence of like every single one of them in that novel.
That's funny. But yeah, and
it's
so that's
like the DNA almost of the novel.
That's my thought on that is that, you know, I mean, the beginning writers are terrified of that, but you know, at some point we are all getting our ideas from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, how many stories have been told about the Greek gods? And
Well, and I guess that actually kind of goes along with the archetype stuff of, what's his name? The Hero of a Thousand Faces. Camel. Right. There we go. Anyway, okay, cool. Moving on. I didn't mean to derail this for quite so long.
it ended up being a longer segue. Okay, writing true. So the Furies of Calderon. Is another book in the series of gems that I've been working through. And this is a line that I came across is on page 321. He said, "The sword leapt across the space between the two of them before the startled soldier could react. And Amara leaned forward enough to let it dimple his throat." And that last bit, "let it dimple his throat," I was like, I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what that looks like right now. Like you just pressing in till you see that crease. I was like, perfect. That was perfect. Nailed it.
Yeah, wow. That's awesome. So I have one. I read Black Hawk Down, and I don't have the actual quote, but he described a grenade going off as a dumpster being tipped off, like, the top of a building and slamming into the ground. And like, I think of that dumpster noise that you hear just when the truck is out there and it lifts up the dumpster and you hear it. Like, it's a pretty heavy
that
boom.
Clanging, but it's like so deep it vibrates.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, he said, it's that as if someone tipped a dumpster off to on the ground next to him.
Yeah.
And I just felt that boom like in my chest. It's like, oh, he nailed it.
All right. So marketing for this week. So when I first started running my ads on Amazon, like you can put in as many keywords as you want. And, you know, I heard, you know, Mark Dawson saying that, you know, if he doesn't have at least 600, he's just getting started. And I was thinking, where do you even get 600 from? Like, how is that even possible? Well, here's the thing. With that ad, you can target a specific book. You can target a specific author. And so what I did is, you know, like I consider my book fairly similar to Dan Brown. So I type in Dan Brown and then I type in every book he's written, right? Each of those, their own keyword. So if people look up one of those books.
You're still only like six terms.
Yeah. But then you pick another author and you go through their list and another author and you go through their list. I think I'm only at like 140 right now, but I'm still working on it.
That's a lot. I'm impressed.
So, and then you go through and you evaluate, what's your cost per click, and is that click rolling over to a sale?
Hmm. Well, and so will you eventually turn some off?
Yeah, so like thriller was one of my keywords, and they get a lot of clicks on it, but it's also my highest costing click.
Mm-hmm. So did you shut it off?
Or I haven't shut it off. I'm going to let it run for a full week, because they were saying that Amazon gives you like a percentage that tells you like how many of those clicks resulted in sales. But they were saying there's like a 2 to 3 day lag on that.
Oh, really?
And so it's like, so I was like, I want to wait a full week before I evaluate, you know, what's the sale to purchase ratio there on that specific one. So, all right. On to the discussion eventually now that we've been talking forever. Okay. So smell is the sense with the strongest association with memory. And for me, my own experience is I dated a girl named Corinne, and she wore this Victoria's Secret lotion. And like that's what she always smelled like. And I had a really strong association with her and that smell. So anyway, so I moved and I met this girl named Jamie, and she was fairly cute, but she smelled exactly like Corinne. She used that same lotion all the time. And I felt very attracted to Jamie, but I never felt like it was real. I was like, I don't think I'm really attracted to Jamie. I think she reminds me of Corinne, not because they looked alike or had similar personalities, but they smelled the same.
Wow.
And it just, I felt like it was stimulating that memory. And so I don't think my attraction towards her was genuine or real. I just think that smell was tricking my brain. But yeah, and so even like real estate agents, you've probably heard of them using the smell of cookies because people say it smells like home. But these studies actually say that like Cinnabon is a better smell. But they say like you will sell more homes because people suddenly it's a pleasant smell and it smells like what they want their home to smell like, right? Like they're throwing some kind of party and there's this dessert cooking, right? And it helps them envision this happy home where they want to live, and it does impact sales. They know that for a fact. They've tested it, right? Because it smells like home. And so it's a very effective tool for provoking memories in people. And locations have certain smells. A sewage plant has a smell. It's not a great one, but it's there, right? And the ocean has a smell. If you've ever seen the Seinfeld episode, right, there's the Kramer comes up with his idea for the cologne, the beach, and then they rip it off and call it the ocean. Right, but it has a smell, and it helps evoke that memory if you've ever been there. Let's see. Oh, so there's I don't know if we've covered this. There's something called signposting, and this is where you use the setting to indicate changes in time, season, or location. Right. So if chapter ends, and then in the next chapter there's snow on the ground, and they're getting ready for the Christmas ball. You know, we've moved forward a couple months into winter. Like, this is very much how Harry Potter moves through the school year, is there's some kind of event connected to a season. And so you'll either see it in the way people dress or snow on the ground. So that's the signposting. Well, within holidays and seasons, there's often specific foods that in turn have a smell, like pumpkin, right? Or holly, or evergreen trees, turkey. Watermelon, hot dogs, hamburgers, all of these are associated with seasons or even specific holidays. And so it's a way to kind of connect people to that moment even more, to evoke their own memories of it. Oh, and or even kind of time of day. Like coffee, people usually associate as kind of a morning thing, right? So people are making the coffee, and then you don't have to say it's 8 a.m. Be like, no, we just started the coffee. So yeah. It's like, oh, it's pretty early in the morning. And so you can use these smells as kind of a way to indicate changes in your scene or setting or time of day without actually saying it's now 5 p.m., right? And finally, you can do kind of mood painting, right? So as you're establishing the mood of your setting, since we tend to kind of throw into either the pleasant or the unpleasant, so you kind of look at what is the opening emotion you want your reader to feel in the chapter. And then you can pick a pleasant or unpleasant scent to kind of evoke that further. So, for example, on my way to work, there's a sewage plant and a candle factory side by side. And
for real.
And so some days when I drive by, it is just absolutely foul. depending on what that sewage plant is doing. And some days I get this whiff of like cinnamon or vanilla, and it's really nice. And so it just has this slight shift in my mood as I go about the rest of the day, because, you know, I have this experience as I'm headed to work. And so you can do the same thing in a chapter. Be like, what is the opening emotion I want them to feel? And will a smell help provoke that further? And then we finally get to word choice and how that can impact how readers understand the smell. And so I've heard all of these used, like smells like roadkill, smells like decomp, smells like blood, and smells like death. Well, the interesting thing there is that is all the same smell, right? What you're smelling is the decomposition of biomatter, right? But each of those words is kind of provocative in its own way and tells us kind of, you know, where we are and what the characters, a little bit about them. If you're roadkill, right, you're probably out in the country somewhere. Oh, yeah, it smells like roadkill, because that's the smell you're going to associate most often with that, right? Mm. What you're actually smelling is an animal dying and decomposing, right? And decomp, I actually heard that on NCIS. The crime scene investigation. Yeah, CSI. Right. And so they go in and they smell it and it stinks. They're like, decomp, because that's what they're very scientific. And so like what they're saying is decomposition. What it smells like is human tissue decomposing, or living tissue, I should say. Right. But it's very scientific in that way. And it was a very well chosen word for the dialogue of these characters in that moment. And I've heard people even refer to it as the smell of blood as well. Just when there's a lot of blood and it starts decomposing, it's just decomp, same as anything.
Interesting.
So, and of course, it is the smell of death, but that has its own very strong emotional tone. Yeah. And so you can kind of look at, once you pick a smell, there's different ways you can approach it to portray either details about the character or the setting, or drive emotion and mood within the chapter.
Okay, I have a question, and I'm not sure there is an answer. But so I can say there was a beautiful sunset, right? Mm-hmm. Or I can get into the orange is mixing with pinks and purple, and there's clouds coming across the top, and there's a mountain silhouetted in front. Like, so now I'm going into the details, right? So what if you want to do the same thing with smell? Like, you can say he smelled pumpkin pie. But how do you start making the pumpkin pie come alive, just as I did with the sunset image? Like, you can say there was a sunset, or you can describe the sunset. You can say there was a smell of pumpkin pie. How do you describe?
Well, I think
I struggle with this big time.
Well, I think part of it is, like, for the most part, humans, we can't separate smells very easily, right? It's not something we do. And so to attempt it is to go counter to human experience, right? Sometimes you can pick it out, be like, "Did I pumpkin pie some cinnamon, right? Maybe maybe some nutmeg." But for the most part, you can't.
So you're drilling into separate smells, though. I like that.
So yeah, a little bit. But like I said, it has to be fairly potent, and you have to have some good exposure to be able to deconstruct a smell like that, right? Like when something's cooking, you can probably pick out eggs, you can probably pick out bacon, but you know. Mm. Maybe some pepper, but a lot of things. Like, if somebody's baking a cake, do you smell like flour, sugar, vanilla? No, you smell cake, right?
So
for most smells with people, we can't separate them very easily. There's certain smells are really potent and they kind of clash, and you can pick them out that way. But it's not something humans are very good at, and so to go too deep into it is counter to human experience.
Okay. Well, I mean, would it be worthwhile to gain a greater smell vocabulary so that you could bring that experience to readers?
I don't know. I've never seen it done, so someone should try it.
Well, because my other question, there's a ship in the book that I'm working on. I'm writing a sci-fi.
Mm.
And so there's a ship that is central to the plot, and I describe its shape. Right? And I can put pieces together by saying, you know, the wings are like semicircles attached to this thing and whatever. If you were like, I mean, are there smells in fantasy, or like, can you make up smells or mix and match? Or anyway, I can describe an object that no one has ever seen and they can see it in their
mind.
But with a smell, I struggle to do that, but I just think it would be super
cool. That would be amazing.
If you could. Like, I don't know. Just somehow give a reader an experience. Like,
whoa. Well, I think the example of pumpkin pie kind of comes back to it. Like, if you can pull together enough pieces to create what you think would be something new, right? Pumpkin pie, you got the pumpkin, and it's distinct. You got the cinnamon, distinct, and the nutmeg, distinct. Now, there's other stuff in there, right? But those are the three that pop out. And so you can kind of do that, you know, imagine these two smells merging into this.
Man, and when you said that, I was thinking of pumpkin pie and ice cream and how those flavors merge. Uh-huh. Maybe you could do some metaphor where taking different smells and saying...
We all have our first experience with a specific smell. Like, and if you want a first experience with a smell, go to like a cologne counter and you will encounter totally new smells there. And try to describe that with your current, you know, olfactory vocabulary and see what you come up with. I think would be kind of an interesting approach. Be like, okay, how would I describe this based on smells that I can actually label?
Yeah.
I know.
So they do that in wine tasting where, man, I should have looked it up, but they'll have a bunch of weird, to someone who's foreign to the experience, it will seem like they're using weird vocabulary. Because the vocabulary attaches to other things in the world, but when you talk about the flavor of the wine, which is actually similar to smell.
Right.
Anyway, so maybe that's another way you could do it. Like take physical objects and start putting those in.
And I think one way to approach a new smell in a fantasy is maybe the character can talk about the first time he smelt it. Mm. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Understand it. And then you can pull from two things real in our world that are in your fantasy world into that new smell. He'd be like, I remember the first time I smelled it, and I couldn't describe it. And then my friend said, or my mom said, you know, doesn't smell like these good. Two things. And then you get that new smell pitched that way. One thing I forgot to mention is, I just thought this was interesting. I don't know how related it was, but I'd read this study, and they talked about that the longer women are in a relationship, the more they prefer the smell of their current partner. And they talked about like over 2 years when they were given a chance to kind of create what they thought would be the best cologne, they always created something that smelled similar to their partner. Like that's what they thought was the best, is because they'd been exposed to it so long and it was associated with so many positive memories that they thought that was the best smell. So that was just kind of interesting.
I think that might apply to males too.
So probably does, but the study was with women.
So
all right, why don't you close this out?
Okay, guys, thank you for listening. Please go on iTunes and leave us a review for the podcast. And we got another giveaway going on this month. Join our
this is VO work. So she's doing 90 minutes of free VO work completely.
Voiceover.
Yeah. And this is final production, right? And so you can, you know, if you've got a short story or a lead magnet, you can use that to turn it into an audiobook as well, right? Because you wouldn't have to pay for the production and, you know, you wouldn't have to risk the fact that since it's a lead magnet, it's free. You wouldn't be dealing with, royalty share issues on a free book. So it's completely free, great for your lead magnet development. And, you know, you wouldn't have to go through ACX or anything. So you could release it anywhere. You could have it on your site, be like, hey, here's a free book, audio as well, you know.
So go to joseph-bendosky.com and sign up.
Yeah. Yeah, and share it on social media for more chances to win. And that's it.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
That's the end of our show, so it's time to start writing. Travis, Jay has wanted me to say that forever.